This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tracy Thorne, is a singer and songwriter who says that she's always written songs which chronicle the milestones of a woman's life, different ages and stages, different realities not often discussed in pop lyrics. She records solo albums now, but from 1982 to 2000, she was half of Everything But the Girl with her boyfriend Ben Watt, who became her husband. They have three children. She left performing to raise them. She writes, "I've been in the charts, out of them, then back in again, been signed, dropped, re-signed, mixed, and remixed. I've seen myself described as an indie darling, a middle-of-the-road nobody, and a disco diva." Our rock critic Ken Tucker described her voice as a deep, throaty sound that is at once a comfort and a dare, a challenge to the listener to be as honest as the singer. Thorne also writes a column for the British publication New Statesman and is the author of the memoir Bedsit Disco Queen and a book about singing called Naked at the Albert Hall. Her new album is called Record. Let's start with her track, Sister. Nobody heard it all.
Don't mess with me, don't hurt my babies, I'll come for you, you'll find you've bitten off more than you can chew. You are the man, but I'm not your baby, I get so scared.
Sister from Tracy Thorne's new album, Record. Tracy Thorne, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show.
So, hi, thank you.
What's the story behind the song we just heard?
Well, I wrote it after I went on the Women's March in London last January, you know, the same day that those marches were happening around the world. And the one in London was huge. And I went off that day, you know, like a lot of people, feeling a mixture of frustration, desperation, thinking, you know, why are we still having to protest this same stuff? But I found the day itself really inspiring and, you know, it made me feel very positive seeing that number of people out on the streets protesting and clearly feeling angry about the same stuff. So, you know, when I came home, I wanted to write something that captured something of that spirit. And I saw a couple of people carrying a banner with the slogan "Fight Like a Girl" on it, and I thought, well, you know, that's a good lyric right there, so that's my starting point.
And what does the line "I am my mother now" mean to you?
I think it's to do with that feeling of, you know, that bond, that sisterhood between you know, women who you're literally related to and other women who you just feel that sort of theoretical sisterhood with. I think as I get older, I feel more and more that sense of turning into my mother, absorbing some of her spirit. She's gone now, so it's partly me conjuring up her memory, I suppose, and feeling myself becoming ever closer to her.
And you've become the mother. I mean, your children are grown now.
Yeah, I am. So, you know, I've stepped into those shoes.
So does the making of this album have to do with the fact that your children are older now? I think two of your twins are 20. Mm. Your youngest is around 15. Do I have that right?
17 is
17.
The youngest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Time flies.
So, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I've definitely got more time available now. And in the last 2 or 3 years, you know, I've got back to doing quite a lot more work.
So in your memoir from 2007, Bedsit Disco Queen, it opens with a story where, like, you're with your husband and music partner in the band Everything But the Girl, and you get a call saying that U2 wants you to tour with them, to open for them. And you don't immediately say yes or no. You think about it. And then at the end of the book, we find out that your answer to that is, I think I want to stop now. And you just kind of stop performing then, unless then a year later you give birth to twins. And you decide to become a full-time mother. Why did you make that choice?
Lots of reasons, really. I've sometimes been asked, why did I stop touring? And I give the reason, well, I had kids, so it was too difficult. We tried touring for a little while, taking the girls with us, and that was very difficult. So I then decided to stop. But honestly, beneath that answer, there's a truer answer, which is just that I was ready to stop. And, you know, it happened to coincide with having kids, so that gave me the perfect excuse. But honestly, I'd reached a point where I felt, in terms of that side of my career, you know, the live performing, I felt I'd sort of taken that as far as I was really interested in taking it. And I was happy to retreat for a while. And then later, when I came back to music, it was on a slightly different level, which is something I'm happy with now.
Now, you wrote that when you became a mother, you felt that you couldn't be the person you were on stage and the mother you were at home, that somehow those two sides of you seemed incompatible. What were those two different versions of you, and why did they seem incompatible?
Well, I mean, I see other women who are perfectly capable of doing that. So, again, I'd stress when I wrote this, I don't want to make this into a sort of general point. But I found it really tricky, especially having the girls with us on tour, and even, you know, having someone else around who was helping. Inevitably, the kids wanted me during the day, so I spent a lot of the day, you know, doing mum things, taking them out to the nearby park, trying to sort out their meals, and then at the end of the day, putting them to bed and getting back to the venue, being in a dressing room, putting makeup on, getting on stage. And at that point, I suddenly felt that at that stage, you're required to turn back into this narcissistic pop star. That's the sort of essence of the job, really. When all day you've been being the self-sacrificing one. And that's quite a psychological split. And for me, it was very difficult. I just found it too tricky trying to be both those things at different hours of the day.
Does being on stage require being narcissistic?
Well, it requires that complete absorption in what you're doing at that moment. I do think there's a degree of narcissism about that. Yeah, there's a look at me element to it, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And even during those hours when I was on stage, it was difficult for me, I think, to have that complete disconnect from thinking, okay, what's happening back at the hotel? You know, are the kids asleep? Is everything all right? Am I going to get a call backstage? All that was a distraction, which was what I think I meant when I said I felt I wasn't such a good performer because I was just distracted.
So I want to play another song from Record. And this song is called Guitar. And it's a song about having a crush on a boy and thinking he was really cool because he played guitar. But he was cruel, you say in the song, and that you realize at some point that he was just the catalyst because you had your guitar. You had a guitar and you could sing and you could play. And it reminds me of something Joyce Johnson once wrote. Jack Kerouac had been her boyfriend.
Mm.
And in a memoir about that period of her life, she wrote that guys had adventures and girls like her fell in love with the guys who had the adventures, and the girl's adventure was falling in love with the guy who had the adventure, as opposed to the girls having an adventure of their own. Being in love with the guy was the adventure.
Yeah.
This song made me think about that.
I remember reading that book.
Oh, really?
Minor Characters.
Minor Characters, yes. Did you love that book?
I loved it, and it rang lots of bells with me. I've resented that idea for a very long time, the notion that, you know, the biggest adventure you're going to have is falling in love with a boy who is having adventures. And, you know, the song Guitar is me looking back and realizing that there was a period of my life when I did buy into that, but not for very long, only maybe for a year or so, I think, in my teens. And it was when I first started getting into music and, you know, a lot of the other boys I knew especially had formed bands, and I watched them do that and it looked exciting. And my first instinct was, you know, these boys are really attractive. They're doing exciting things. And then I bought my own guitar and I thought, well, hang on, I can do this as well. You know, it looks like they're having a load of fun. I don't just want to actually watch them have that fun. I want to have that fun as well. So the first band I joined, I was the only girl. And I remember immediately feeling a little bit like I'd got kind of secret access into this boy's gang. And so around that time, you know, there were a couple of boys in bands who, whilst I maybe thought for a brief moment, you know, that they were the ones doing the exciting thing, actually what I was also doing at the same time, once I'd picked up a few chords on the guitar, was I was starting to write. And I think what the song Guitar is about is that moment in my life when playing a guitar, realizing I could sing, just was the beginning of everything for me. You know, everything that followed came from that moment. It was the moment that opened up my ability to communicate and, you know, and make art. And, you know, that's become my so much of my life.
Yeah, well, I really like this song. So let's hear a guitar written and performed by my guest Tracy Thorne from her new album record. Tracy Thorne from her new album record. So you've described that once you started playing in a band with boys, you felt like you'd gotten this secret access to this kind of boy gang. But then you formed a group with other girls.
Yeah.
How was it different?
I think I realized pretty quickly that the access to the boys gang was always going to be slightly limited. And there were times when I began to think, okay, they're sort of implying that they, you know more about this stuff than I do. But when I came to think about getting another band together, my next thought was, okay, I think maybe this time I'll do it with other girls. Let's see if that works differently. So I formed a band with some girls at school called the Marine Girls. And yeah, it was different. I think we felt quite a defiant sense of proving that we could do this, that we didn't need boys to show us how to do it. We broke lots of the rules of what a band was supposed to be doing because we didn't really know what those rules were and we were not very respectful of them. So, you know, we never had a drummer because we didn't know anyone who had a drum kit. And I think we just had this attitude of, well, who says you need a drummer? You know, we were just kind of thinking, we're going to do what we can do. We're not going to sit around worrying about what's been done before and what you're supposed to copy. We're just going to think, right, what can we do? How can we write songs? And so there was a real sort of combination of naivety and innocence about it, but also a defiant spirit.
So after being in a band with guys and then forming a band with other girls, you ended up going to college. And at college, you soon fell in love with Ben Watt, who became your music partner and your life partner. I mean, you've had children together. You've been together since what year?
1981.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you formed the band Everything But the Girl. And you write that this was the time when you discovered feminism and made you question, was it the right decision to be in a band with your boyfriend? Was it even cool to have a boyfriend? Was monogamy inevitably awful and oppressive? And should you really try to be a lesbian?
Yeah.
So, some of the questions you were asking yourself at the time, how did you work through those questions?
In the way you do when you're young, which is you just kind of live your life. And, you know, the questions sort of answer themselves on a day-to-day basis. You know, I think if I was going to be giving advice to, for instance, one of my daughters now who was doing what I did, you know, moving in with a boy who she'd met on the first day at university, forming a band with him, you know, throwing everything in hook, line and sinker with this person. I'd say, that's really risky. Don't do that. Or at least if you do, keep lots of other options open. You know, don't shut any doors. But, you know, I was reckless in the way that young people are reckless. And I was in love and I just thought, what could possibly go wrong? So while I was asking myself these theoretical questions, on the other hand, I was just carrying on living my life in the way you do when you're young. You know, you just crack on with things.
So some of the questions you asked yourself about having your boyfriend, now husband, be in the same band with you was, would the relationship take precedence over work? What if you had a fight? What if you stopped being a couple? Would there still be a band? Did you have to confront any of those questions?
Not seriously, but I do think one of the reasons we haven't gone back to it is because I think we both have looked at each other and said, do you know what? We did quite well there. We got away with it that many years, and it might be pushing our luck to try any longer, especially now we've got kids. You know, our relationship now is even more complicated. When we were working together, we were working together and we were a couple. So there's those two relationships. Now we've got that shared relationship of being parents. And that in itself brings a whole nother level of complexity into a relationship. And, you know, now we have to navigate that thing of, okay, how do you carry on being a couple once you're parents? And that takes some work and some effort. And again, you know, so far we're managing to make that work. But I don't think either of us want to risk bringing back the working relationship so that, you know, there's this kind of three-pronged approach going on. It just feels like too much. And, you know, now we're working separately, and that seems to me to work very well now.
You know, you've written that your voice got deeper because of menopause, and I think it's great that you wrote about that because I think a lot of women are uncomfortable acknowledging the existence of menopause. It's personal, and it's also a sign of age.
Mm. Yes, no, I think that's right, and especially in music, obviously, which, you know, there's still a lot of pressure to, you know, maintain an image of youthfulness. So as soon as you bring the word menopausal in, and sexiness, and so as soon as you bring the word menopausal into the room, I think a lot of younger men especially might run screaming. And so that's a risk I'm prepared to take.
So I want to play another song from your new album. This is called Smoke. It's a kind of political song. It's a song about your love of England, about your parents and grandparents growing up in England. And you say, London, you're in my blood, but I feel you going wrong. So is this a song about Brexit?
Maybe partly, but it's also just what's happening to lots of cities. You know, the same thing's happening to London as is happening to New York. You know, that hollowing out of a city. I talk in the song about the fact that my family had lived in London for a couple of hundred years before I was born. And then my parents' generation moved out to the suburbs after the war, because London was largely a bomb site. And so I grew up in the suburbs, but I grew up desperate to get back to London. And London for me represented everything that a big city represents, you know, freedom, diversity, a place where people are creative and live cheek by jowl and it's exciting and all that stuff. And that was why I was desperate to get back to London. And that's my worry about the way in which it's changing now. You know, if it becomes a place that's only inhabitable by the super rich, then all that is lost. And, you know, I think that's very worrying. And it's true of other cities, obviously, but for me, you know, I have very emotional feelings about London. So that's what made me write that.
In the song, you talk a little bit about your mother experiencing the Blitz in London during World War II and how a friend of a friend was blown to bits. Did you grow up with a lot of war stories?
I did, but in the way that I was never really made to take them that seriously. I don't know whether it was a generational thing or a thing about being British, but both my parents had been in London during the Blitz, and they both told stories to us as though it was something out of a kind of, you know, a war film that was semi-comic. So my dad had a story about being blown out of bed, literally being blown out of bed. But he made it comic. You know, he implied, oh, and there was me and my brother, and next thing we knew, we found ourselves on the floor. So I grew up with the stories told in that tone of voice. And it really wasn't until I got quite a lot older, you know, perhaps old enough to start empathising with my parents as people who had a past and who'd, you know, been young once, and, you know, beginning to wonder what their experiences were actually like. And then I began to think, okay, my parents did actually have the experience of being in their bed and, you know, a bomb being dropped near enough to be blown out of your bed. So that makes me look at it in a different light now.
Right. Well, let's hear the song Smoke from Tracy Thorne's new album, Record. Tracy Thorne, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In good time, they had a son called James, who had a son called James. Were there no other names? The First World War, and the second one came. The second one came, the second one came. My mother now was a teenage girl. She survived the Blitz, she survived the Blitz, though she knew.
Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a book by Zora Neale Hurston that's just been published for the first time, although Hurston died 5 decades ago. It's called Barracoon. It was written before Their Eyes Were Watching God and the other books that made Hurston's reputation. In 1927, while she was working toward her degree in anthropology, her deep interest in Black history and culture led her into what became one of the most remarkable conversations of her life. Barracoon resulted from that conversation. Here's Maureen's review.
I want to know who you are and how you came to be a slave. That was one of the first questions that Zora Neale Hurston asked 86-year-old Cudjoe Lewis when she traveled from New York to Mobile, Alabama to interview him in the summer of 1927. Back then, Hurston was studying anthropology at Columbia University and doing field work, collecting Black folklore and historical data. Cudjoe Lewis was already known to those who cared about Black history. He was the last known living person who could recount firsthand the experience of having been taken captive in Africa and transported on a slave ship to the United States. Cudjoe spent years in slavery, and after the Civil War, helped found a settlement called Africatown near Mobile. That's where Hurston interviewed him over a 3-month period, coaxing Cudjoe into talking about the past with gifts of peaches, ham, and watermelon. The short book-length manuscript Hurston produced in 1931 was called Barracoon, named after those structures, like holding pens or stockades, where captured Africans were confined before being loaded onto ships. Hurston's manuscript has a complicated backstory, but the gist is that the book generated little interest back then from publishers, Only Viking Press was willing to publish it with the stipulation that Hurston change Kudjoe's voice, transforming his dialect speech into the king's English. Hurston refused, and Barrackoon languished, known only to scholars until now. For skeptics who believe that all the archives have long been plundered and all the literary treasures of the past have already been published, Barrackoon will be a conversion experience. It's a monumental work, not merely because it describes aspects of the slave trade that largely went unrecorded, but also because it vividly dramatizes two extraordinary voices in conversation. There's Kudjoe haltingly retrieving his painful memories, and there's Hurston, listening, nudging, and sometimes making impassioned commentary on what she's hearing. Both Kudjoe and Hurston often make their points poetically. For instance, in her introduction, Hurston points out what's missing in other books written about the slave trade. "All these words from the cellar," she says, "but not one word from the sold. The kings and captains whose words moved ships, but not one word from the cargo." In Barrackoon, Hurston is determined to give the last living representative of that black cargo his say. The first thing Hurston seems to have learned about Kudjoe was that in Africa, his name was Kasula, which is what she calls him. The second thing she learned was that digression was an essential part of his storytelling style, which sometimes made her impatient. But Hurston's frustration falls away when Kudjoe starts telling her about the events leading to his capture in 1859. Kudjoe was 19, and a neighboring tribe led by female warriors massacres most of his neighbors and family and takes him and other young people captive. The memories are bloody and grisly. Hurston ends her account of that conversation by commenting, "Kasula was no longer on the porch with me. He was squatting about that fire in Dahomey. His face was twitching in abysmal pain. It was a horror mask. He was thinking aloud and gazing into the dead faces in the smoke. His agony was so acute that he became inarticulate. He never noticed my preparation to leave him." In her moving forward to Barrackoon, Alice Walker says that Kudjoe's stories of the atrocities that African peoples inflicted on each other wounded Hurston. But nevertheless, she kept returning to Kudjoe's porch, asking him about the Middle Passage, his enslavement in Alabama, and the later struggles he and his wife faced as displaced free people, trying to eke out a living for their six children. By the time Hurston met Kudjoe, his wife and all of his children had died. Once again, he was the last survivor, and he was terribly lonely. He told Hurston, "When the earth eats, it don't give back." True enough. But in writing Barrackoon, Hurston found a way to ensure that the earth didn't swallow Kudjoe Lewis's precious words.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Barrackoon by Zora Neale Hurston. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Lydia Bastianich has a devoted following from her public TV cooking shows and her cookbooks and restaurants. She just won a daytime Emmy as Best Culinary Host for her program Lydia's Kitchen. Bastianich has a new memoir called My American Dream that describes how she came to love preparing food and how being a refugee and immigrant shaped her life. Those two parts of the story are interconnected. The year she was born, 1947, the peninsula her family lived on switched hands from Italy to Yugoslavia, which was under communist rule. Many of her earliest memories are of spending time in her grandparents' village, where their food came from animals they raised and the vegetables and fruits they grew. It was farm-to-table cuisine, poverty style. She learned a lot about food from her grandmother. When Bastianich was 8, She, her parents, and brother fled communist repression, became refugees in Italy, and then in 1958 immigrated to the U.S. When they arrived in New York, they had nothing and couldn't speak English. Bastianich married at the age of 18 and later opened a small Italian-American restaurant in Queens, New York. Its success led to other restaurants, including Felidia in Manhattan. Along with her daughter and son, she now owns restaurants in New York as well as in several other cities. Lydia Bastianich, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's talk about your life. You spent the first few years of your life on the peninsula of Istria, on the Adriatic Sea, and after World War II, it switched from being part of Italy to being part of communist Yugoslavia. The language where you live changed to Croatian from Italian. And the secret police were keeping an eye on your family because, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. And the whole thing changed. Now, I was just born in that period. So, I didn't notice this immediate change. But what I did notice in growing is that there was two parts of my existence, and that was the secretive part in the house, whispering in Italian, sometimes talking about religion, and then the oppressive side, growing under communism and having to follow the communist dogma. They changed our names. I couldn't speak Italian openly, certainly not go to church. My mother was an elementary school teacher, so she was really watched. And so, the whole kind of anti-democratic dogma and this adoration for President or Josip Broz Tito, and, the kind of one-for-all communist doctrine, if you will. Everything became communal. Farms were taken away. My father had a business with two trucks, and, he certainly was deemed a capitalist. The trucks were taken away. He was even put in prison for about 40 days until they clarified that he didn't have other alternative motives of, kind of undermining this communistic dogma that he wanted, to profess capitalism and so on. So it was a tough period. And that's why we ended up spending a lot of time in Bussolere with my grandmother and in the courtyard, which for me was idyllic.
Mm-hmm. And that was in part because in the countryside in this village where she lived, it wasn't patrolled by the secret police like this city where your parents were was patrolled.
Yes, exactly. The town was quite small. I mean, one main road and houses on each side. Everybody knew each other. Everybody had a little plot of land. And especially in these times, even food became scarce at that point. So whoever had a grandma and a little plot of land, they grew food for the family, to feed the family, the animals. Everything was kind of a ritual. The whole workday was focused on producing food to feed the family.
So your family decided that they needed to leave and actually get to Italy.
My family, after my father was being kind of followed and all that, decided that maybe, and that took about 8-9 years, because we were sort of grown by then, and I guess they felt they could go into the world with us. That's my brother and I. He was 3 years older than I am. There was the border, and of course, on the Italian side, we had some family that was kind of left on that side, and we were on the other side, on the communist side. So my mother decided that supposedly our great aunt Nina in Trieste was not feeling well, and so we got a visa, and that's only the three of us, my mother, my brother, and I. My father, they wouldn't give a visa. He had to remain, as a hostage, in a sense, so that the family wouldn't not return. We went to Trieste, visited the aunt, stayed with the aunt, and, the aunt looked fine to me, but we were just excited to be in Trieste. And then about 2 to 3 weeks later, my father escaped the border, literally walking about 50 kilometers, crossing the barbed wire fence with the dogs. They were shooting at him, but he made it. And we reunited in Trieste in 1956.
It's an amazing story. And then after you got to Italy. Your travel visas ran out pretty quickly. And
well, our visas did. My father had no papers at all.
Right. So you needed to like go to the police and become official refugees.
Well, yes, because had they caught us, you know, had the police stopped us in the street and we had no papers, then they would have taken us as some sort of political intruders or, you know, and they could have repatriated us. So my parents made sure that we went to the police officially and declare that we didn't want to go back to Yugoslavia, that we'll remain as refugees.
So you were given housing in the San Saba, which I call it complex, that used to be during World War II, it was a concentration camp. And I didn't even know there was a concentration camp there. You didn't know it was a concentration camp when you lived there either, right?
We didn't. It was sort of a transfer camp, holding camp, or whatever you call it. But it was before that, it was a riseria, ricery in a sense, you know, milling rice and whatever. So that's what it was called, and it was known, but it was. San Saba was before being a political refugee camp, where we ended up in, was a Nazi camp, concentration camp. It wasn't a big one, but it was. And in 1956, when we came, it became a political refugee camp for all the refugees escaping communism from Eastern Europe that came through Trieste. That was sort of a holding place.
Had there been a crematorium there?
They say that it has, that there's the signals of a chimney and all of that. And I mean, I saw the chimney when I was there, but, you know, no mention was made of anything. And certainly, you know, at my age, I guess they wouldn't tell us that, or maybe they just didn't. I think the aftermath of the war was a very sensitive for everybody, and everybody was at edge, if you will, especially in that area.
How old were you?
I was 10, from 10 to 12.
So you were able to go to school. And it was a Catholic school. You were taught by nuns. And you worked in the kitchen with the nuns. And you said that their food began to heal you. What did you learn from the nuns who you work with about preparing and serving food?
So in the camp, we were held in there until they vetted us and they found out that, you know, we weren't spies, that we were just a simple family and actually of Italian heritage that wanted a new life. So they gave us a kind of a lascia passare, a permit to leave the camp certain hours of the day. We had to check out and check in. And my mother was given an opportunity by a family, a woman that had an autistic child, and she wanted my mother as a teacher to spend some time and teach and talk to the child. And in turn, she subsidized my schooling in the convent that was actually right close to her house. And in that convent, I was I just loved it because I began to sort of interact with other children, speak Italian, and the religion came back in my life. The nuns took me under their wings, knowing that I was a child that, you know, had not been educated in the religion, in our religion, because of being under communism. So it was a great setting for me. And also, to sort of help subsidize my schooling, they put me in the kitchen. I don't know why, but I guess they sensed, you know. And the kitchen was more of what I did with grandma, you know, kind of peeled potatoes, apples. But it was, for me, the first kind of entree into a commercial kitchen, seeing these big pots. They were cooking lunch for all of the students and for the nuns. So it was fun to kind of be in the kitchen, help the nuns. And I even felt kind of special that I was the even though I was an immigrant, that I was the child that they chose to put in the kitchen.
So I imagine you learned things that you could later apply in a restaurant.
Yes, absolutely. It built the base. But you know what I think really, and in retrospect, thinking back about my passion of food, why am I so connected to food? Why? It goes back, I think, to when I realized that I, you know, I'm not going back to grandma. I'm not going back to Boussolaire. And for me, it was, you know, unfinished business. I didn't say goodbye to grandma. I didn't say goodbye to my animals. I didn't say goodbye to my friends. And slowly food became the substitute, the connector. I would cook foods that grandma cooked, you know, even if it was as simple as polenta and milk in the morning, which was usually our breakfast. Those flavors, those aromas brought grandma back to me. And, you know, I continued to cook with this kind of desire to connect and to remain connected.
So in 1958, you and your family immigrate to America with the help of Catholic Relief Services. And Catholic Relief Services emerges as a real hero of this book and your life story. They helped you get passage to America. They found you a hotel room to stay in when you first arrived. They found a house or an apartment for you to rent. Afterwards, they helped your parents find jobs. They gave you money, and they didn't want to be repaid, even though your mother insisted on repaying them. They wouldn't accept it. But anyway, so you were how old when you came to America?
12. I was 12, 1958.
Didn't speak any English, but you learned
None
it within
us.
A year. And then you were in school, being
yes.
like an outsider, a newcomer, without any facility with English. And it was, I imagine, pretty hard for you. And you still had to deal with food, but with food in a foreign country with very little money and no garden or animals or, you know, fruit trees or any of that to deal with. So how did the world of food change for you in America?
Well, it changed tremendously. You know, at 12 years old, though, you are, at least I recall being very, very, I was happy. I was so happy that finally we came to a place that where we are going to stay. We are going to build our home. And I was excited about learning the language. I was excited about becoming an American. I was excited about making friends, you know, whose language I didn't know. And I was excited also by the food. You know, I must say initially, things like yodels and bread cakes and all of that stuff amazed me, you know. And then
did you
and
like
then
yodels? Because I'm going to confess here, my mother used to buy yodels all the time. I thought they were a little, I don't know, bitter or something. They looked like they'd be really sweet, and I thought that they didn't taste quite right. I was never a big fan, but you love them.
Well,
I love that
I'm
talking
them.
To you about yodels, by the way.
I love them because, you know, there you go. You went, you opened this package, and you get this kind of delicious texture. And, you know, we didn't have that, you know, or any desserts or cake. When it was the festivities, we made it, and it was limited and so on. So, you know, to just be able to throw it in your cart and bring it home, and I saw kids had it in school as
wrapped in tin
lunch.
Foil.
Wrapped in, yes.
It's like a tin foil
yes.
wrap.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. And so I was amazed by all of that, and I was excited. So food was different. Peanut butter and jelly. I still like it today. And sometimes, you know, at night, peanut butter and jelly and a glass of milk, I like it.
What I love in the book, you basically become the cook for your family for dinner because your mother's working. It's a long commute, and she doesn't get home early enough to prepare dinner. So you're preparing dinners, and then you start making like a Duncan Hines cake from a cake mix box. And like you're totally fascinated with the idea of this cake mix in a box.
Well, you know, it made me so successful. Yes, my mother worked late because first we settled in New Jersey. And then we moved to Astoria, but she kept her job in Jersey because she was afraid she wouldn't get another job. And so she came home just in time, 6 o'clock, for dinner. And she would prepare for me just like a regular recipe, you know, the potatoes, the beans, whatever it was that I was cooking, put it in, cook it half an hour, and so on, all the instructions. So I would do that. But then I discovered the cake mixes, these wonderful kind of boxes that you added one egg to that mix or maybe some butter, put it in the oven, and voila, this fluffy, delicious cake would come out. And then, you know, even the icing, they gave you on the side how to make the icing with powdered sugar and whatever. So I was thrilled. And almost every night we had a cake for dessert. Now, that was the good life for us. You know, we weren't used to that. And it made me kind of, oh, an accomplished cook. I made a cake with every dinner. It was great.
Were you used to anything that sweet?
No. We didn't have that many sweets, candies or that. So the whole thing was kind of a discovery.
So what's it like for you to hear how immigrants are spoken of today with such, you know, distrust from our own president?
Well, you know, my story certainly is non-political, but it's a human story. And I can't help it when I watch the television to see those children in camp. And yes, they run, they're joyful, but I know what they feel at night when they go to bed and how they think, what's tomorrow? Are my parents going to be with me? Are we going to have a home? Am I going to make friends? You know, am I going to see my relatives again, my grandma and whatever? That I know that those children have the same thoughts. And so I feel really connected. And, you know, hopefully me telling my story is a story, a good story. It's a story of somebody that, yes, faced adversity like, you know, a lot of people are facing today, but, you know, given a chance and working hard and being spiritual and staying strong to those basic values can take you to great places. So I hope that, you know, with this book, that message comes up for many people maybe that are wondering.
Well, Lydia Bastianich, it's really been a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on Fresh Air.
Lydia Bastianich has a new memoir called My American Dream.